tam kamayanam bhagavan uvaha yajusham patihi tushtayam tosham apanno janayadvara shatmajan. The lord of the ritualistic performance of yajna later married Dakshina, who was anxious to have the personality of Godhead as her husband. And in his wife, the Lord was also very much pleased to beget 12 children. Purport. An ideal husband and wife are generally called Lakshminarayana, to compare them to the Lord and the Goddess of Fortune. For it is significant that Lakshminarayana are forever happy as husband and wife. A wife should always remain satisfied with her husband, and a husband should always remain satisfied with his wife. In the Chanakya Shloka, the moral instructions of Chanakya Pandit, it is said that if a husband and wife are always satisfied with one another, then the goddess of fortune automatically comes. In other words, there is no disagreement between husband and wife. Or where there is no disagreement between husband and wife, all material opulence is present, and good children are born. Generally, according to Vedic civilization, the wife is trained to be satisfied in all conditions, and the husband, according to Vedic instruction, is required to please the wife with sufficient food, ornaments, and clothing. Then, if they are satisfied with their mutual dealings, good children are born. In this way, the entire world can become peaceful. But unfortunately, in this age of Kali, there are no ideal husbands and wives. Therefore, unwanted children are produced, and there is no peace and prosperity in the present world. We have to engage all of our propensities, all of our nature, in the Lord's service. This is the process. So, the basic sciences, one should be always remembering Krishna and never forget him. So now, accordingly, how we remember, how we forget, this has much of the time to do a lot with the purity at heart. When the heart is pure, it makes it much easier to remember and not forget. Because if the heart is pure, then there is nothing to distract it from remembering Krishna. Otherwise, the tendency is it will think of something else other than Krishna because this is its interest. Due to the modes of nature, it will have an interest other than pure Krishna consciousness. So now this becomes a difficulty because our basic principle is to chant always. We're following the path of the acharyas, and so Haridas Thakur's acharya showed how we should chant always. Always be chanting. The idea is Kirtaniya Sadahari. 24 hours we should be chanting the holy name. And in that holy name we should be absorbed, satisfied, seeing Krishna, seeing the name is non-different from Krishna, and being perfectly satisfied in our relationship with the holy name. So, but the difficulty comes up is that due to our conditioned nature, we have so many desires, so many things that are there other than just chanting Hare Krishna 24 hours a day, not bothering with eating, sleeping, where we stay, what we wear, what we eat. You know, if it happens, okay. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't matter. So then a difficulty arises. Well then, what are we going to do with all these desires? Because the process of chanting, we will purify them. But if we have chanted today and we haven't become completely pure, then we could expect that then it may take us a little time, right? If we have come in contact with the holy name, and upon taking the holy name, then we are chanting in ecstasy, then within a short time, pure love of God will come. So So then, very nice, no problem. This is Krishna's first recommendation. This is what he says is the best path to go back to Godhead. Is just surrender to Krishna immediately. Fully, 100% surrender. On the spot. We see the gopis doing this. The wives of the yagyic brahmins are doing this. Like this, many are doing this. But if one can't do this, then Krishna gives the process of sadhana bhakti. So the sadhana bhakti then, in a regulated fashion, because the mind is not naturally attracted, this is the meaning of the devotional service in this attractive form, is that you like to chant, you like these things, and you're very absorbed in them, and you like to please Krishna in this way. You see, the name is non-different from Krishna. So you're very satisfied in this. There's no need of any other engagement. The mind is fully engaged. But the problem comes is that in the mind, it has been polluted by the idea that I am the enjoyer. And because of this, this taints all of our other activities. So if we're the enjoyer, then unless we're getting some enjoyment out of chanting, and then how much can we? If I'm the enjoyer, then the problem comes is the holy name also claims to be the enjoyer. And he claims to be the supreme enjoyer. And we're not the enjoyer at all. So this is a new concept for us. We have been in this material world since time immemorial. And this thought never crossed our mind, that we're not the enjoyer, you know, that someone else is the enjoyer, and we're servant. So then, bad habits, they take some time to change. So habit, you change by a new habit. If you have a bad habit, you can change it by intelligence and by regulation. Then you can establish a new habit. So instead of always being thinking about ourself, our own desires, our own what we are looking for, what we are desiring in life, then we have to practice the process of sadhana bhakti, which then establishes that there are other priorities in life. That Krishna and his name, his form, his qualities, his pastimes, these are actual worth thinking about. These are actually worth being attracted to. And so then we have to do this practice in a regulated fashion. Means if it is a spontaneous attraction, regulation is not necessary because you'll always do it. Means any like small children, you don't have to regulate them and say, okay, now we have to develop in you a nature to play, right? Children are supposed to play. So that therefore, at this time of day, we will practice playing. No, it's basically it's the opposite. They have a natural attraction to play, and you have to establish within them a regulation. So they just play. They like to play. They like to eat. They like to yell and scream. All these things they do on their own, and they'll do it all day, as much as they can, whenever they can. So this is the spontaneous platform. Of course, this is material spontaneity, but this is the point, is that we take up the chanting and we always are chanting, then sadhana bhakti is not so important because we will always be chanting. But if we're not doing that, we're distracted by material desire, therefore at a regulated time we should chant at this time. We should, you know, the Lord is the perfection of form. We've heard the name now, form. So then at certain times you go and stand in front of the deity like that. His qualities, we sing his glories like this. We hear about his pastimes. So in a regulated fashion, then we have the artik ceremonies. We have the kirtans. We have the Bhagavatam discussions. So in this way then, in a regulated way, we are able to always engage in the Lord's service. So sadhana bhakti then means 24 hours a day you are engaged in the Lord's service. Everything you do is connected to the Lord. Right? On the spontaneous platform, then everything's connected to the Lord because at every moment you'll be hearing and chanting and remembering the Lord. So then 24 hours. Then perfection. But if not, then sadhana bhakti for 24 hours. Is 24 hours, everything in your day is chalked out. It is exactly in connection with the chanting of the holy name, the preaching of the holy name, and hearing about the Lord's glories, worshipping the deity, and there's no space left for anything else. So then, this is the process of sadhana bhakti. So then, this is the next recommendation. Okay, you're doing what the pure devotees would do, but you're doing it because it's regulated. You're not necessarily doing it because this is what you want to do. It means we want to become a devotee, but we don't know how to become a devotee, right? A child, you don't have to teach them how to eat. They spontaneously, just anything they see, they grab and it goes in the mouth. So what they're learning is what not to eat, right? Eating, they know, that they know. Everything is tested, whether it's edible. And those things that are not edible, then they're rejected as edible. But eating you don't have to teach. So when the chanting and remembering the Lord doesn't have to be taught, the gopis don't have to be taught. Right? They just naturally remember Krishna. Right? They can be shown how to greater increase that, but their natural attraction to Krishna, that doesn't have to be taught. So, means they don't go to school, they don't sit down and learn the Vedas and all these things. So like this, they don't have to be taught. But we see if that's not the natural propensity, then we have to be taught how to love Krishna. What does Krishna like? He likes his name to be chanted. He likes to be chanted in a particular way. He likes us to dress in a particular way. He likes us to deal with other devotees in a particular way. He likes us to eat in a particular way, walk, talk in a particular way. This was Arjuna's first observation, is that when he heard that there is something called spiritual, like that, he was doing his dharma, he was a kshatriya, he was doing his duties, and then he became bewildered because it appeared that the performance of his duties wasn't going to give a pious result. Right? Out of piety, he is a kshatriya, is going to fight. Then he looks at it, and this is not going to give a pious result. Right? We're going to end up with a lot of problems here. Plus, yeah. So then Krishna explains to him the spiritual path. Then immediately he asks, well, such a spiritual person, how does he walk? How does he sit? How does he do things? Because there is a culture behind whatever is done. There's the theory, what is there, and then there's the practice. So that practice is culture. Right? Generally nowadays, culture is just reserved for, you know, going out to some auditorium and hearing some, you know, musical or some dramatic performance. And that's culture. Like that. And everything else other than that is not culture. But culture is how you live, how you do anything. It means activity that is culture. Right? Even the mind is thinking. How does it think? That's culture. How the senses are engaged, how the body is dealt with, this is culture. So this is the thing, is important to, means the theory must be practically applied. So in the Bhagavat Marg, we see that one is always chanting, and because he is always humble, right? Trinada Pisa Nichena, Tarora Pisa Hishnuna, Amanina Maana Dena, Kirtaniya Sadahari. This is the culture in a nutshell. He's respectful to everyone, and he is tolerant of everything in the material world, and he is, therefore, that is the culture. He chants 24 hours a day, and he follows this culture. It's perfect. And then what happens with the body, he doesn't worry. Maybe it's dressed, maybe it's not dressed, maybe it's fed, not fed, because he's not worrying about what's happening here. He is only absorbed in the transcendental. So in the transcendental realm, in a transcendental form, then he is following the transcendental culture. And he is serving Krishna behind the eternal associates, following their culture. So culture is being followed. We don't see it. We simply see a very humble and quiet person that is always chanting and never offensive to anyone and never disturbed by any situation. That's all we see. Right? That much of the culture comes through. But if this is not coming for us spontaneously, then we have to be regulated in a sadhana and the culture that goes with that sadhana. Therefore, we will be dressed in a particular way. We don't know how to dress, so we have to dress in a particular way. We don't know what to eat. We have to eat in a particular way. We have to do all these things. So therefore, then the sadhana bhakti then becomes complete. Its theory is perfect, and its practice is perfect. Just as the Bhagavad is a perfect package, the Pancharatrik system is a perfect package, complete. So then, with that combination, then one is regulating one's life, and then one is preaching. It's perfect. There's every aspect of one's needs is taken care of. There is nothing that is left out. But now, if we find ourselves in a situation that we have more desire, or the conditioning is greater than what is taken care of by the Bhagavat and the Pancharatrik mark, then the question comes, so what are we supposed to do? So many emotions are there, so many feelings are there, a desire for, you know, a tradition other than just the spiritual tradition. You know, there's family tradition, then there is the relationships within this, husband and wife, the parents and the child, the family and the community. And there's all these various feelings are there, needs are there, desires are there. What is one supposed to do with that? Pancharatra doesn't deal with it at all. Neither does Bhagavat. Right? These systems on their own are for people who are beyond this. They don't require this. So then what is one supposed to do? One has these emotions. He has these desires. He has these needs. So how is one supposed to engage them? So then Krishna says, if you can't become perfect by sadhana bhakti, then you work for me. So then when we bring in work, it means because Pancharatra already engages one in work all day. Bhagavat already engages one in chanting all day. So then what is this work? So this work is according to our conditioned nature. We have different varnas, different ashramas, and these works are done simply to please Krishna. But they acknowledge all these material conditioned nature and desire. One has desire for family, one has desire for so many things, wealth and facilities and all these different things. So, but it is given to us in a regulated fashion called the Daiva Varnashram system, where everything is connected to the Lord. Therefore the term Daiva. Varnashram means simply material nature is seen, and the pious is separated from the impious, and the pious is categorized in a function, in a system that makes for perfect social functioning. Everybody has a part they do, like a machine. Everybody has a part that they play in the production of this machine, and you get perfect results. But that will still, it's material. So then, how is this going to help us in our march back to Godhead? Therefore, then the Daiva Varnashram system is how to connect, see each and every aspect of the Varnashram system in relationship with the Lord. Then, the other aspects outside of our sadhana and preaching then are able to be engaged in the Lord's service. Otherwise, the tendency is, okay, we've come to the temple, we've chanted our rounds, we saw the Mangal Arati, we heard the Bhagavatam class, and now the rest of the day is mine. Right? Or in the temple, I dress very nicely, behave very nicely. I go home, I dress how I like, behave how I like. You know? Or, yes, you know, at the temple, you know, that time is for Krishna. Another time is myself or my money. Okay, I have this much money. It goes in this little box over here. And the rest of the money is all mine. Like that. My wife is mine. My family is mine. My possession. Everything's mine. Right? It has this big sticker on it. Mine. Right? And so then this creates a problem. There's a duality here, which will be very disturbing because it will create an identity crisis. Right? The whole thing is the living entity is conscious, therefore there is identity. And so the idea is there must be focus of that identity. Perfect understanding of identity is to understand our eternal relationship with Krishna in the spiritual realm. That is our identity. Then we know we serve Krishna in this particular way. And the essence of that is I am servant. Right? From I am servant, that expands into a spiritual form and spiritual activities in the spiritual realm. And in this material world, then identity as I'm servant then expands through Pancharatra. And if some elements are not covered, it expands into the Varnashram. So it must create an identity. If you have two identities, you're going to go crazy. Because one of them must become prominent. So then either one will become more materialistic and just relegate Krishna consciousness to something, some pious activity, right? The eighth offense. You know, chanting Hare Krishna is a pious activity, giving in the Vedas. Or one will become fanatic the other way and say anybody who has any of these desires outside of just sadhana is maya. So this is a problem, because here we see there is no, it's not being applied, the philosophy is not being applied, because there's no social structure. Right? If we're not taking care of all these needs, we're not taking care of ourselves, our identity is not complete. Or if we reject these things, so niyamagraha, we either take them so much or reject them. But both of them are due to ignorance. We don't know what is to be done, what is not to be done. So the Daiva Varnashram system then is so that we can understand how every moment of our day, whether it is in sadhana, whether it is in preaching and chanting and hearing the Lord's glories, or whether it's in our household duties, we know how to connect each and every aspect. So there's not even a moment that's not connected to the Lord. So that is then the purpose of this third stage, the Varnashram that's being done for Krishna. Right? So this is differentiated between the next stage, which is Varnashram not done for Krishna, kind of done for Krishna. Because then he says, if you can't do that, then you give the result. So the difference between these two is that one is what Narad Muni preaches, which is called Naishkarmya. So this Naishkarmya process of Varnashram goes very nicely with the Pancharatric system. And we see Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, all the acharyas, they have recommended this system. Naishkarmya means is that you understand this is not mine, but I have the conditioned nature that has to be dealt with. I have the desires of a grihastha, so therefore I need to address those desires. So how do I address them? The things are mine, it's my house? No, it's Krishna's house. But because I have the need to feel I am in control of a house, therefore Krishna has given me as a quota, as a grihastha, a house. But it's not my house, it's Krishna's house. So Krishna says, take care of this. Right? So then we have to take care. How? The way we like? No, the way Krishna likes. So therefore then our house becomes engaged in the Lord's service. We have a desire for relationships in this house. Therefore there's wife, there's husband, there's children. But they are Krishna's wife, husband, and children. They belong to Krishna. They are Krishna's devotees. So therefore, how do I deal with a devotee, right, who is in the capacity of husband, wife, child? And so that means I have to do it how Krishna wants it done, not how I want it done. Right? So this is the process of Naishkarma, is that you see this belongs to Krishna. So all the things are done. Right? Everything's being done. Economic development is going on, you know, sense gratification is going, everything's going on, but it's done according to how Krishna says it should be done. Not otherwise. So this is Naishkarma. This is working for Krishna. And it's very dynamic. Like that. Generally what happens is this point is missed by practically most living entities. Most living entities miss this point. They understand sadhana, and they understand giving something for Krishna. Right? It's my home. Right? It's my wife, children, my money. But I spend some time for Krishna. I give some money for Krishna. I encourage the wife and children to come sometimes to the temple and offer their namaskar and put something in the box over there. Isn't it so cute? You know, our little 3-year-old child put the coin in the box. How cute. Nice. So nice. Religious. So it is done. It's better than nothing. It is. It's a step in the right direction. It's being done for Krishna. But only that moment is for Krishna and the rest of the time is mine. So then it's the Daivavarnashram, but on a very beginning level. But, you know, one has to start somewhere. So this is very odd. Okay, yes, I'm a grihastha, I live outside, I do as I like, and I'm a pious person, you know, I've heard, I like to come and do something. Or then you have those in the temple fired up, fanatic, like this and that, and everyone outside's in maya. Right? These two fit very nicely. Everyone can relate with these very well. But this one in the middle, where I have these needs, I engage them fully, but it's all done to please Krishna, how he does. This does not make sense. Why? Because everything I've ever done is being done to get a result that I want. Every activity, nothing we do is done without this. So I'm doing the sadhana because by that sadhana I'm going to get Krishna. And the others, I have material desires. By doing these activities, I'll fulfill my desires. So here you have an act one where I'm doing this activity not for myself. The result is not for me. Right? Here, this verse about yajna. So in yajna, then whenever you offer something, then the Vedic verses, you're offering it, let's say you're offering it to Krishna. Idam Krishnaya, idam namama. This is for Krishna, it's not for me. So the offering is for the Lord. Krishna says, he is the offering, he's the mantra, he's the ritual, he's the person making the offering, he's the paraphernalia, he's everything. So it's not for me, it's for Krishna. So this is a new process. Right? No, I'm doing it for someone else. Right? The Bhagavad, I mean, is... Okay, we can theoretically understand that, and we are always chanting, always thinking of Krishna. Okay. Pancharatra, yes, rules and regulations are there. I did this. I picked up the spoon, put water on my hand, hand became wet, now hand is pure, right? Immediate result. I want my hand to be clean, and I do it, and it's clean. I offer arti. I can see the ritual, and I can see the result. But now here's a system that's in between. I'm performing the activity, even the result I'm seeing, but it's not my result. So this is something very special. So this is what Krishna is saying in the Gita. This is what he's telling Arjuna. Arjuna is thinking, I will do my duty, and I will get the result of, you know, getting rid of Duryodhana, then I will be sitting on the seat, we'll be emperors of the world, everything will be very, very nice and wonderful. Right? We'll be happy, prosperous, you know, Draupadi won't be complaining anymore. It'll be wonderful. Then he gets on the battlefield and figures out that everybody that he wants to enjoy the kingdom with is on the battlefield. And it's not that all the good guys are on one side and just Duryodhana and his brothers are on the other side. No, it's mixed. So he can see that the result is all there's going to, everyone will be finished. So then he can't enjoy, right? This is that fourth principle, is I'm doing my duty as a Kshatriya, okay, like this, you know, Krishna wants to fight, okay, yeah, we go fight, you know, but it's his fight. Right? Yeah, something that's offered, Krishna wants it, okay. But it's his fight. His fight with Duryodhana. Then he sees it's not nice. So he says, I won't fight. So then his idea is, be adharmic, give it up, just do whatever you want. And Krishna explained, no, this is nonsense. You're supposed to, the spiritual life, you understand the soul, all these things. And then the conclusion is, Arjuna is wonderful. Oh, spiritual life, this is great, fabulous. What's the conclusion? And Krishna says, fight. And then Arjuna says, what's this? I was going to fight and all that, and I'm speaking so many nice things about Dharma and Varna Shankara and all these things, and then you're telling me I'm a fool. Then you're explaining all this nice spiritual knowledge, and then the conclusion is I'm going to fight. You know, it's right back to Dharma. So he can't understand what's going on. So then Krishna explains this process of karma yoga. Is that you have desire, you have nature, you have need, but you do that not for yourself. That's what Arjuna was doing in the beginning. A pious person following Varnashram for himself. Right? Some connection to Krishna. But Krishna is saying, no, you will become entangled in this way. Like that. Some benefit is there, but a lot of entanglement. You have to do it to please him. Right? That's the point. Fight. Do your duty, because you can't get away from that. You have these desires, you're going to fight anyway. You go to the forest, you'll fight. You stay here in the battlefield, you fight. Anywhere you go, you'll fight. You're a kshatriya. But now you fight for me. Do it the way I want it. And that everything you're doing is because Krishna wants it. So then you have to see, how does Krishna want it? And do it that way. That has to be the research. How to do it for Krishna. How to do it for Krishna. Then it becomes perfect. So this process of naishkarmya, that then takes the conditioned nature and engages it, but in a way that's favorable to Krishna consciousness. So therefore, it is fire against fire. Right? If you have a big forest fire, then they start another fire that then burns the other one out. So that between the two, there's nothing left to burn and the fire goes out. So we have these material desires, but they're kindled in such a way that they're used for Krishna. And then in this way, the material desires themselves are burnt up in the process. So at the end of the process, there is no material desire. So that's the purpose. That's why it's different from what we're used to. You know, we're used to the idea is, I do this, it increases material desire. Therefore, spiritual is to do nothing. That's the impersonal. But Krishna is saying, no, with knowledge of the jnani, you have to perform the activities. But for him. Then it becomes perfect. So this is the Varnashram system. And this is the Varnashram system that's being discussed in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So therefore it's an integral part of the devotional process for one who is conditioned. So then we can see from here that Bhagavatam is therefore not just a book of philosophy. And the examples that are given don't apply. Yeah, it's something, okay, 5,000 years ago, they had some meaning when the culture was there. No, these apply today. They also apply to us today. Whatever our situation is, we can take from this. This is how the devotees live. This is how they deal. And so we see here these things. Here then, the household life is described here in a nutshell. You want to become a grihastha, or one is a grihastha, and one wants to live in it peacefully and go back to Godhead. Here it is, right here. Is that the husband and wife are trying to please each other. Now how are they trying to please each other? Just any old way? No, how Krishna says it should be done. Right? The wife is representing Lakshmi, so she has to be dealt with in a certain way. She can't be exploited. Right? Lakshmi has to be dealt with properly, protected. Husband is representing Krishna. Right? Lakshmi Narayan. So then, husband has to be respected and dealt with in a proper way, a particular way. then if these are there, then it works nicely. And the details here, wife is satisfied with whatever comes with the husband giving his proper endeavor. A husband he's a conditioned living entity. He has a particular nature, and that nature carries with it a particular karma. And therefore he can do particular activities that give a particular result, and that is it. It doesn't matter how great our material desires are, it's not any more than that. No less, but no more. If in his activities and 8 hours of work in a day, he can get 1 lakh of rupees, he's not going to get 1 lakh and 1 paisa. He's only going to get 1 lakh. And he will not get, 999,999 rupees either. He'll get 1 lakh. That is what his nature can do. And that's it. So, therefore, the wife has to be satisfied with that. Whatever the husband can provide, that's it. She does not dream of more. She can dream all day, but she should not expect it, and she should not ask for it. Because then she's asking the impossible. Because the husband does not have the nature to get one more paisa, not one more bangle, not one more sari, not one more pot in the kitchen. That's it. And if she wants more, she will be unsatisfied. And if the wife is unsatisfied, then the whole atmosphere in the house becomes very miserly. Right? The wife is satisfied, then, like Lakshmi, everything is very opulent. Everything is very much shared. Opulence and poverty do not have anything to do with how much you have. It's what you do with it. Right? You can have somebody with not very much money, and their mood is very opulent. They don't waste money, but there's no shortage. Whatever's there is enough, and they have enough. In this atmosphere, very pleasant. Otherwise, one never has enough, and one always feels there's less. And in this miserly atmosphere, then the children will be like that, and they will be worse than the parents. Right? This is the teachings of Manu, is that the parents, if they're not properly behaved, or they are mixed in an improper way, the children will be worse than the parents. Right? As we see nowadays, as you have the parents and then their children, it's like when I came to India, now it's different. Well, I'll take it a fourth step. When I came to India, there were 3 steps. You had the painting on the wall of the grandfather, right? There with his turban on and his big tilak and his chadar, and his, his peg shoes. Very, very religious, right? Then you have the father, not dressed so well, puts on tilak at some occasions and that when it's not too embarrassing and all that. And, he's quite religious and all that. Then you have the son who just looks like everybody else, right? So that's it, And nowadays, this was in those days, they were wearing dhotis and stuff like that. So now you'd have to put the next generation in blue jeans, like that. So then it would be, so we can see it's just getting worse because the culture and the values are not being handed down because the parents themselves don't have it. You can't give something you don't have. So if you wonder why each generation, because the parents don't have anything to give. They don't know what to give. Mother is thinking they always wants more, 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 more. So the child then is born wanting more. Right? Mother may be piously wanting more, but being born in that situation of wanting more is not pious. Therefore, naturally, your inclination is impious, wanting. So instead of, nice saris and nice bangles, now they want, nice super tight jeans and very tight knit, t-shirts. Like this. These are the desires. Different. Actually, in one sense, it may be a benefit because it's jeans and t-shirts are much cheaper than good saris, but it's the same time as the men are less qualified, so they can't make very much money. So it's they can't go out the brand that the wife wanted. They have to get the cheap brand. So the whole point comes is that when the wife is satisfied, then everything becomes opulent. Because the nature of the woman is, Whoever she's satisfied with, whatever she has, she shares. And if she's not satisfied, you know, it's like, you know, enough to fit on the tip of a pin will not be given. And then we see the husband, he has to be trained to take care of whatever the needs, the best of his abilities. He has to be sensitive. Am I providing the proper amount? Is the wife satisfied? So with this combination of both trying to please each other, the house runs very, very nicely. But in this, then we must see, like here, they are devotees. And there's worry about devotees. And we see here specifically, in this example here, is that Swayambhuva Manu, he then appointed his daughter. Appointment of daughter means that the father gives the daughter to a suitable husband on the condition that the first son then will come back to the father. Like that. So that's generally for the purpose of you don't have a son, so then to carry on the Shraddha ceremonies and all this. You know, it's one of the duties of the Grihastha. So then he is following these kind of tradition. But his interest is here is because the son is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So therefore, the appointment of his daughter. So even that has been connected to the Lord. You see. So all these different things, one has to see that we can't just leave it up to our own emotions to decide what will be done and not, and chart our course. Because if we have faith in this system, then if we look at it, how long have we been in the material world? We've been here a long time. And all this time, we have taken our mind as the supreme authority in our life. So now we have to see is that we have to control this mind with the intelligence. And the intelligence must be guided by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Then with that, then everything becomes perfect. Everything becomes perfect. So then whatever the situation in life, it does not matter. That's the beauty of this Varnashram system. Daiva Varnashram is one position is not better than another. Each position is decided on the conditioned nature. So if one has a conditioned nature of a Grihastha, Grihastha is the perfect situation. Because that will purify one and bring one to the transcendental platform. One doesn't have this, he has a conditioned nature of a Brahmachari or a Sannyasi or Vanaprastha. He does that. And that situation will bring him to the transcendental platform. So that is the uniqueness of the Daiva Varnashram, is that every situation is perfect for someone. But they must follow it according to Krishna's desire and the direction of the scriptures and the acharyas. So any questions or comments by the revered Swami? No? Any questions? Or?
Could you give a brief explanation of what is the exact meaning of Pancharatra and the history of Pancharatra?
Pancharatra. Basically, the simplest history is that Lord Krishna had taught Brahma all the Vedic literature. And after he had heard all the Vedic literature, then these two demons came from the back of the body of the Lord, Madhu and Kaitava. So this is before creation. So then they came, and they were very special demons. So they were not like regular burglars that they would go break into your house, that they could break into your mind and steal the contents thereof. So they broke into Brahma's heart and stole the Vedas. And so then Brahma didn't know the Vedas. He had lost it. So, you know, like that. So then Brahma, then being very intelligent, he went to Krishna and said, "You please again teach me the Veda, but because at any moment I may die, right? Therefore, first teach me the essence of all the Vedas, and then after you've taught me the essence, then teach the whole Veda, because that will take some time." So then 5 nights, Krishna taught Brahma the essence of the Vedas. So that 5 nights, or Pancha Ratra, is that body of knowledge on how to know the Lord. So we see its practical activities, how to know the Lord, like directly. Because here's the Lord. He has come in the deity form, and we can directly render so many services to Him. Like that. So therefore, it's the essence. Because the Vedas, the whole point is to do activity. You always remember the Lord, you don't forget Him. So what does that mean? You're going to do something. Right? You remember, I am servant of the Lord, and I should develop love for the Lord. Therefore, there's an activity that will get me that love. Right? Every action has a result. Right? But now we're being asked to do it to please Krishna. Results not for us. Right? So, therefore, the Bhagavat system, the Pancharatrik system, the Vedic system, it's all activity. Right? And so then it's based on we're servant, and it'll give a result. So the Pancharatra then is how the conditioned soul can very quickly and easily attain the result by engaging the conditioned nature in the service. So that's the main meaning. There's also other meanings. You know, one that makes other 5 branches of knowledge go dark. Pancharatra makes night fall, like karma, jnana, yoga, all these Vedas. Then Brahma asked, okay, what's the essence of these Vedas? He gave him the 4 verses. Those 4 verses were given to Narad. Narad gave them to Vyas, and Vyas then expanded those 4 verses into 18,000 that we know as Bhagavatam. So this is practically how Bhagavatam, therefore, is also the same conclusions that you'll find in the Pancharatra. Like that, because it's the essence of the Veda. You know, to serve Krishna. But here it's showing us practically how to do that through all these different levels. As a Bhagavat devotee, as a Pancharatrik devotee, as following Varnashram, how to engage all these levels in Krishna's service. Right? So then here we see, you know, the example of how very perfect household life is going on. Like that. So we're supposed to learn from this. It's not just, oh, a nice philosophy. No, philosophy has to be applied. This is how it's applied. Very simple. And it's not even something could only be practiced 5,000 years ago. Why? The wife could only be satisfied 5,000 years ago, not today. Husband can't be sensitive enough to see what the wife needs. Only 5,000, no. So therefore, these ideas that the Vedic culture can only be followed before, can't be followed today, it doesn't work in a contemporary environment. That's all just lack of what Prabhupada called poor fund of knowledge, a lack of understanding. It can be perfectly applied today. It's just a matter of desiring it and trying to understand it and trying to practice it. Anything else? Why there is suffering means you have a good reason why there shouldn't be. Why shouldn't there be suffering? Never thought of that one, huh? Why shouldn't there be? Right? Means we can look at it from 2 platforms, the material and the spiritual. Spiritual, then, well, let's look at it the other way. Material. How do you say something is good? Right? Like, let's say I give you a sweet. I go to the best shop here in Bombay and get their most famous sweet and give it to you. And then I go to some little place on the side of the road, you know, like that, and get one of their sweets and give it to you. Okay? Now, how can you tell that one is good? The quality. But what is the other one? The other one? Inferior, yes. So because one is inferior and one is superior, you can tell the difference. Right? Now, to some person, that's the best sweet. But you give that sweet to somebody from, let's say, a very traditional Orthodox family where they don't eat anything outside and they have a very, you know, respected tradition of cooking. The people in that family will say, that's inferior. And whatever their mother cooks is much better. So how do you tell good and bad? It's simply relative. Something's worse than the other, something's better. So that's the whole thing. How do you tell what's happiness? Right? You're outside, it's hot, sweaty, no breeze. Then you walk into the office, it's air conditioned. Then, do you feel happy? Yes or no? Yes. But for how long? Yes. And then what happens after that? There's no pain, so there's no happiness. Right? The happiness of cooling off in the air conditioner is only as long as you still feel hot. As soon as one is cool, there's no more happiness. So, therefore, even in the material platform, unless there's suffering, there's no happiness. So this ideal, I will always be happy, doesn't exist. It can't exist, because you'll get used to it. Oh, if I just had this money, or if I just had this wife, or I just had this house, or I just lived in this place. But once you get there, right? It's just like you go to, you know, like in Switzerland there, right? Mountains, snow, everything like that, cold, like that. So then it says holiday in Italy, right? Nice beaches, wonderful weather, sunshine, and everything like that. So they go there. And then in Italy, because it's nice and sunny and always wonderful, then they have things that say, go to the Alps, snowing and, you know, nice outdoor resorts. And you understand? So therefore, it's just, this is better than that. Right? So that's all. All it is the mind going from one thing to the next. And it'll take according to what's good. Of the two. Okay, I got to marry this guy or that guy. Well, this guy's better than this one. That's all. You'd rather marry that one, but it's not available. Because he's better than this one. Right? That's until, of course, you see something better than that. But you've already married this one, so we're pious, so we stick with this one. Right? But the point is it's all relative. So there is no real standard. There is no happiness or suffering. Right? You know, in the movie, the young boy and the young girl are standing in the rain, and they're happy as anything. Right? Are you happy when you're standing in the rain with no umbrella? No. So therefore, suffering is relative to the mind. It has no... It doesn't really have any meaning. No? Sorry. So therefore in the material world there is no happiness or suffering really. It's just what your mind perceives as happiness and what it perceives as suffering. That's all. So therefore it creates variety here. And then one is satisfied to stay here since time immemorial. But then after a while, one starts to see no matter, you've done everything. That's the thing. Someone who becomes a devotee has already done everything. So there's not that there's a matter of I didn't do this or didn't do that. Or, okay, I'm running my household life and, you know, things aren't going so well. I could have done this or could have done that and it would have been better and I would have enjoyed more. No, you've already done all those things. In previous lifetimes, you've done everything perfectly. You've been Brahma, you've been this, you've been that, you've been everything. Every species of life, you've done it, and you've done it well. It's not just once, you've done it quite a few times. Enough times that we can see there is no happiness here. Right? So then we see, then suffering has another purpose. Suffering has a purpose in that it awakens that there must be something else, because I always want to be happy. Eternally I want to be happy. I don't want to be happy just for a minute. I want to eternally be happy, you know? But the problem is every time I eat, I'm happy, but after 10 minutes I'm full and I'm not happy. You know, whatever we do, it has an end. So there's no happiness here. So then one starts to inquire, is there something higher? And if one gets a good association, then one understands the Supreme Lord and one's relationship. Then one actually understands why we always want to be happy, because the soul has a nature of ananda. And ananda means eternal happiness in a relationship. Right? Then we understand our eternal relationship with Krishna, and then we progress from there. Then we become actually happy. So that suffering then becomes an impetus for us to turn to the Lord. Like that. So therefore, the suffering on the material platform is to create material variety. Otherwise you get bored. And on the spiritual platform, the suffering is an impetus to go back to Godhead. But ultimately, when one's situated on the transcendental platform, he's not disturbed by happiness or distress. You notice that why is there suffering? No one's asking the question, why is there all this happiness? You know, why so much happiness? Right? Unless it's, why are they happy? Then yes, that question comes up. But why am I happy? No one asks, right? Why am I suffering? Why am I happy? I'm so happy. Why am I so happy? Why should I be so happy? Everybody else is not happy. No, we're perfectly happy to be happy, right? So therefore, we should use our intelligence to understand that the transcendental platform, that's where we can always be happy. Because there the happiness is always increasing. Well, here it's always going down. That's why then, you know, it goes down. We were happy with it, it gets worse, worse, worse. And then at one point, then it's a little better again. And so nice, right? There's a saying in English, it was better when it was worse. Right? Like before, things were bad. And then you think, this is so bad. And then things get worse. And then you think, before it was better. Right? You know? Like that. So that's... that. Does that answer your question? Do we keep going here, or is there a cutoff? Or what is the... keep going? Last question.
In case of a student who's attending your lecture in his class, so how can he remind Krishna all the time?
How can we remind of Krishna all the time if we're in a lecture as a student? Now, it depends upon whether it's important to get a grade out of that lecture or not. Right? Means if the lecture, you don't have to be, you don't need it for your grade, then you can just chant or read or remember Krishna. That's the simplest thing you could do. If that lecture is important for getting your grades, then the point is knowledge is coming from Krishna. Right? And so then knowledge is coming to us then in the form through this particular teacher. So then we have to respect the teacher as someone who knows this knowledge. Right? Because if there's no respect, there's no transfer of knowledge. Right? And there must be service, so therefore one has to listen. There must be submissive inquiry. There must be desire to learn. So these are the principles. Whatever you want to learn, this is the process. There must be a desire to learn. There must be proper inquiry. There must be proper practice of that. And there must be service. Right? So then we see that the whole educational process has just come out of Gita. Krishna is saying that. So therefore, if we want to be a student, then we have to follow Krishna's process on how to learn. And we see that the teacher, or the parent, or the guru, they are representing Krishna through this knowledge. though from this teacher we can only get material knowledge in this subject. So that's the end of our respect on that platform. Right? But then for other Vaishnavas, then we can get so much more. And the Guru and the Acharyas, then even more. So, therefore we see is that we will behave properly in the class, right? Because this is a proper way of being a student. You know, we will pay attention, we will, you know, try to understand and try to see how to apply this knowledge. And then then in that we're getting some degree, and some then we have to see how to use that for Krishna. Right? We have a conditioned nature that we have chosen this particular degree. So we're engaging that, and then with that we'll use those skills for Krishna. You know, either in our preaching or in our household life, like that. So you see, it is connected, but it's a little distant. It's not as direct as the Pancharatrik or the Bhagavat system. Right? The Bhagavat's the most direct. Pancharatrik then is pretty much direct, but it's still through rules. And then the Varnashram is rules. And, you know, it's based on the same principles. You know, like, we have to respect authority. Krishna is the supreme authority, right? So then in the Pancharatrik system we have Guru, and then in the Vedic system we have so many Gurus, right? Like any senior person in the community or that is Guru. But we see is that they're Guru and that they're invested with a small potency of the Lord. While in the Pancharatrik process, the senior Vaishnavas and the Guru is invested with much more. That's why the Vedic system is servant to the Pancharatrik and the Bhagavat. We can't overbalance it. The smartest try to overbalance it. They put it as the prominent. And then there are those who then throw the Varnashram system out. So both these are wrong. It has its place, but only this much. So that's why eventually even the Varnashram system is given up, therefore also sannyas and these things. Because naturally with time one wants to use a more direct system. But as long as material desire is there, it's a perfect system how to connect that material desire, emotions and needs to the Lord.
Right. But I beg your pardon, but if a student, he's morally attracted towards being in devotees and worshipping the Lord in temple than going to the college. So at that stage, what must he do?
Means, see, there's a thing called duty. Every ashram, every varna has duties. So now... A duty establishes relationships. That's the main purpose. Our philosophy boils down to sambandha abhideya prayojana, a relationship, process, and goal. So, actually, it's all sambandha, because you have a relationship with the Lord, with the devotees, with the material energy. Right? And then, based on this relationship, there's a purpose to that. We develop love for Krishna, for the devotees. Right? And then there's process, there's activities that are done to expand and express that love. So the Varnashram system and the Pancharatrik system are to engage us in relationships. Right? But because the nature of the living entity in the material world is to be a bit impersonal because of I. I means is impersonal. Mind is karma. Right? So there's always karma and jnan. So I, aham, that's the jnan. And the mind, that's the karma. So we're always affected by these. So we tend to not see the relationship in this. Like, mother is always telling daughter to do this and that, dress properly, behave properly, you can't do this, you can't go out there, you can't go with these people. And daughter is thinking, oh, I'm so restricted, I'm this and that, why doesn't mother give me a break? Everyone else is doing it. But what she's missing is this is establishing relationships. One between her and her mother, but also it's going to establish a proper relationship between her and her husband, her and her community, her and her guru, her and Krishna. So all these things, it's for establishing a relationship. But Because nowadays people are only interested in the relationship of the sense and the sense object. Therefore, they throw out the higher levels of relationship between people and the emotional social platform and the transcendental platform. Right? So, therefore, when you are on the sensual platform, then things based on emotion or transcendence, those relationships, are seen as a burden. Right? It's something you don't want to do. Therefore, duty takes on a bad connotation. It's my duty to do it. It means I do it because I'm supposed to, but I don't really want to. Right? But actually, duty should be evoking strong spiritual or emotional sentiments. Right? Means the husband and wife are chaste to each other. That invokes very strong relationship between them, strong emotional bond between them. If you look at it from the sensual platform, it's just socially I have to do this, otherwise I'll become an outcast in my community. And right at this present, then business-wise, it's not good to do that because I'm not established so well on my own. Plus, you know, they live in the same city, so unless we want to move somewhere else, it'll be a lot of trouble. So therefore, I do it because I should do it, not that I want to do it. You know? I'd rather just drop the relationship and run off, you know, like all the girls in the movies run off with so many other people. Be like that and do like that. But I don't because it's too much hassle. Right? So that's duty being done just because it has to be done. But as soon as there's a gap. But the other is that you have a relationship with the other people. You want to please them. You want to make them happy. So here, husband is trying to make wife happy. Wife is trying to make husband happy. Therefore, the relationship works. But they're not materialists. Therefore, they're trying to make it work and please each other according to Krishna's direction. That's what makes them devotees. That's what makes it Daivavarnashram. Not that they don't try to please each other, but they do it according to Krishna's direction, not according to their own direction. Does that make sense? Like that. So a student has his duties to study and learn. And so then these things must be done. Because this knowledge will be valuable. More detail of that, then you speak to your local authorities. Because they can tell you how these things are, you know, used and applied. Like that. I can simply talk theory. Okay? So we'll end here. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jainitai Gaura Premanandi.